It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new... So, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
That is the worst idea I've ever heard in my life, Tom.
What's that?
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Alt. Jimmy on the board. SP Futures up 70. 75. Yeah, 75. NASDAQ Futures up 463. The world is all correct again. Yet another pause in the war. Are we not exactly sure why we're there, but there's a pause in it. So oil is down $6 to $83.09 after trading up to like 90-something the other day. So that's a good news. S&P Futures is also up. That's good news, I think, for just about everybody. And stuff has been coming down lately. Do we have Mr. John Lee?
I'm here.
See, you should feel good this morning.
Why should I feel good this morning?
There's a pause in this war. Everything's okay. Trump has got a new way to put out tariffs out there. Instead of taking the news from the Supreme Court that it's not his job to put out regression taxes on people, I really can't believe that the guy puts out a tariff that is blatantly illegal, even though he's been talking about tariffs since 1980-something, which is clearly not the Republican position whatsoever. It was not Ronald Reagan's position. And so he puts his illegal tariff out there. The Supreme Court calls him on it. He abuses the Supreme Court. We end up, the U.S. of A, and here's how there's not really a we here, pays the people who paid the tariffs, but not the people that it went through. And instead of people being outraged that this is at this absolute garbage, now he's doing it again, and everybody says, "Oh yeah, well it's on these other countries, it's not on us." What is wrong with our education system here?
Well, I mean, no, this is, I think it's a different issue. I think the issue, and they've purposely done this, is, you know, if you make things so chaotic, Tom,
yeah,
after a while, people give up. Even, I was talking to a therapist, and not about me, but I should have probably, but he said, you know, I mean, and this is, and I've also read this, the people, you know, one of the goals here in this administration is to have people depoliticize, is to give up. You make it so chaotic, you make it so ridiculous. Now, I mean, let's, you know, Trump is only half the problem. The other problem is a branch which falls in line with him. You know, I can't believe there's not even 10 Republican senators that would go along with this. But hey, but no, this is, you know, that you get exhausted trying to fight it. You
this
get
goes
exhausted.
To show you that we really have no check and balance in the government, at least not after now. The Congress.
No. And so the chaos just breeds. I mean, how long? Okay, I talk about John Lee here. Or Tom Howe. How long can we be mad about it? I mean, we can't spend our entire life mad about it, because in a normal world, this would go away. He would lose the Supreme Court. Okay, fine. I'll do some things around it. Now he just comes right back and does it.
And people, you know, so, and people refuse to believe that it's on them.
Oh, of course they do.
Why, yeah. Why is that? I mean,
yeah.
What fool me once, you know, shame on you. Well, fool me twice, shame on me.
I think that the first time, shame on me.
What you know? What is? How do you write, you know, tens of billions of dollars checks to Nike, Walmart, Target, and those kinds of places, and them not put pass anything through? How do people not realize, God, that was me? I mean,
yeah.
Hey, I got a car story for you. Just goes to show you how you should never, the things you learn on Stocks and Jacks. This is one of the most bizarre, you know, sometimes when you notice something, it seems a little odd. Somewhere along the line in life, you find out how odd it really is. You ever remembered of the, it was an incredibly popular show, Highway Patrol?
Yeah.
With Broderick Crawford and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. That's where the you know, the famous line, 10-4, 10-4. You know what that means?
No, I don't, actually.
It means I copy, I got you. I hear, I,
okay.
I, there's a whole 10 range of 10, 10 somethings with a number after it that all means something. Like 10-10 means repeat, or 10-8 means repeat, or something. Anyway, so the show was an you know, iconic, absolute. 10 million people used to watch it, supposedly. The first year or two, I noticed that they always had 55 Buicks in there, because we had, when I was a little kid, we had a 55 Buick Special. And this was the Century model, and I knew the Century model was a little more powerful than the Special, but I never really... So all of a sudden, I see this thing on YouTube about Buick Special car, the first hot rod. And I go, what in God's name is this? So of course, I click onto the thing, and it turns out back in the, like, 53 or 54, when everybody came back, the soldiers from California, they had all these pictures on this YouTube thing of California in those days building, like, these tract housing for people, you know, people came back from the war, all these wooden things that would take, like, 3 days to build and stuff. And the highways are already jammed, right? Well, the state police decide, look, we can't outrun all these guys in these cars. We need a car where we can outrun anybody else. So they go out to bid four different... You know, two or three different, actually it was four, because everybody had a different division in those days. They went out for bid on the car, and the car, you know, I didn't you hear about period pieces, you know, people are somewhat interested, but in those days, you didn't necessarily arrest people, highway patrol, you just gave out tickets, and if you did, you had a paddy wagon, I guess. So they didn't really care about a back seat. They wanted it so that the policeman could get in and out easy, which means they wanted a two-door. But they wanted a post two-door. For anybody who doesn't know, the old cars, if you had the post in the middle, like you see today, it's a sedan between the front and the back seat. If it's not, if the windows just meet, It's called a hard top. I don't know if anybody even knows that anymore. But anyway, so they wanted a two-door with a post. So Buick, the Century model, had the bigger motor in it, but they didn't have a two-door with a post. So they said, okay, we're going to use the Special, which is a lighter weight, smaller motor car. That's the one my stepfather had. And so we're going to have to use the Special body. So they take the Special body, they essentially cut the front end off, weld the frame in of the Century, which is a beefier frame, and plunk in the motor of the Roadmaster, the big honking thing with like 300 and some horsepower, 1955. Then they go, okay, we got such a hot rod. Then they put the Roadmaster brakes on it, which were like twice as big. So they got this totally tricked out car. But the weird part of it is that you'd never see today. It was not available to salesmen. It was not available to the general public. It wasn't even available to Buick executives. The state police ordered 673 of these things, and they made exactly 673 and delivered them. Nobody else got one except for the state police. Well, they liked the show so much that they gave a few to the show, and that's where I saw them on the first year or two. And then I'm thinking, what happened to them after the first year or two? Because then you see them in a Dodge or some other stuff. It turns out Broderick Crawford was such a drunk, even though he was a big star of the show, that they actually had a name for him. He was like 05, which I guess is a drunk driver. So he loses his license. So after like the second year, anytime he was driving, they had to do it on a private road because he couldn't drive on a highway. Even to shoot a scene, they would let him drive on a highway because he was drinking when he was when he was on the set. You read this stuff, it's like, God bless, how could all this have been going on? Anyway, I'd love to have one of those cars. Plus, they made half of them stick and half of them automatic because they want to know which one the people like better. I'll bet they like the automatic better, I'm guessing. But imagine a police guy driving a stick shift, but I guess they did. Anyway,
remember when the stick shifts used to be on the column?
Well, that's what they were. They were on the tree. I've never driven one of those.
Three on the tree.
Have you?
I think I may have once. This is at Dad's dealership. Okay, because one of his employees, now this goes back to early 70s, one of his employees had, I think it was a Saab. And it had three on the tree.
Really? I thought all foreign cars had it on the head or on the floor.
And, I mean, that brings back memories.
I had a Fiat and a Toyota, and they all had it on the floor. My GTO.
So for your listeners, Dad had a dealership in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And, nice, wonderful college town. And as I look back, this is an aside, as I look back at my high school education, went to Pioneer High School. And in reality, that was really a private school. I mean, every teacher was a graduate for you at University of Michigan. But anyways, my story is Dad had an Oldsmobile dealership. Okay, and it was a large dealership. And this is back in the heyday of Oldsmobile. Oldsmobile in its heyday in 1980 sold as many cars as Nissan does today, or did it during Nissan's heyday. So Dad said, these guys walk up and they're representing these Japanese companies he's never heard, like Toyota and Honda. And he goes, get out of my office. And we all know what happened to that story. Oldsmobile stopped selling cars, went out of business, and then he was desperate to find foreign cars, so he went and
Audrey's cousin had one, and he ended up suing Oldsmobile because Oldsmobile, they came around, and there was a time, I mean, God, we were going through like auto history on Saturday night at dinner, believe it or not, and the. Way back when your dealership, they really only had a few cars for you to go buy. Everybody ordered a car, and you ordered it however you wanted it. Then all of a sudden, a few guys said, "Look, it's way easier if somebody piles in their old one if you have something to sell them when they drive home in the new one." So then all of a sudden, people started having all kinds of cars. And actually, GMAC, you may think that they made the most money on retail people, but they actually made the most money by essentially talking dealers into buying cars, and they had to pay the juice for the car on their lot because most of the dealers, if they had their cars there. Now, Chrysler did it the other way around. Chrysler, the Chrysler Motor Company, probably one of the reasons why they didn't do as well, they ate the juice. the people got the cars on the lot for free. So over a long period of time, that was their biggest winner. If a guy had 100 cars in the lot and he didn't sell them, he's paying the juice on 100 times whatever the car was. I mean, it's a fascinating industry, like any industry when you dig into it. But hey, what do you I was on Joel's show last week, and they were asking about all the economic stuff that's going on, and I said, no, first of all, none of this stuff is essentially tradable. You can't say, boy, I think this stock sucks, or the economy sucks, or the economy's great, or the car, and expect to buy it in the morning, and everybody else come to your point of view by like noontime and have a winner, right? You know, it's just, you sort of can't do that. The timing is, even if you're right, which is, you know, you're not always right, you're probably not right that moment. And yet, I look at what's going on this over this Korean stock market, and they've had a 30% drop. Yeah. And but you know, but here I keep talking with somebody. Will ask me, they did on Joel's show, what? So if you really want to fight inflation, like what would you do? And I said, well, first of all, there's one way to fight it, and that's to use the Fed instead of pouring gas on the fire like they're doing. You go the other way. You know, you lower you. At least stop the growth of the money supply. Maybe you even raise the margin requirements on stocks from 50 to, say, 55 or 60. I'm not saying the guy should do this tomorrow, and I'm not saying that's my job. But I'm saying if you really wanted to do what your diarrhea of the mouth new Fed chairman saying he's going to do, like he's really going to fight and trade, that's the way to do it. It's as simple as that. You know, if you want to put out the fire, get the hose. I mean, right? What else you and so. In Korea, guess what you can be margined on a stock? Here it's 50%. 500.
What?
500%. So you can essentially. So what would that even be?
So what does that relate to in real world?
If you bought a stock by 100, I think for 100, I think you could pay $5 for it and borrow the rest. Is that the math? Something like that.
So I'm looking at the stock market, and
well, it can't be 500 because they'd be paying you. It must be when you actually get a. Let's take soybeans. You know, if it's a $50,000 contract, you put up $5,000. It's 10%, right? So I don't even know what 500% means. Maybe, but some guy was up to 500 before they cashed him out. Whatever that.
So
means.
The stock market's gone up by a factor by at least threefold.
Yeah.
Since March of last year, April of last year.
Yeah, and then it just came crashing down.
And now it's down 20%, 25%.
Yeah, in like a week.
At least.
Yeah. But it's the margin calls are dramatic. Now, it's nowhere near as bad here because, first of all, you got to put down 50, and then you don't get a margin call until it's 30. But after 30, it's dollar per dollar, which I think a lot of people forget, but it's dollar for dollar after that. Now, what I mean is, if you want to buy, say a stock's $100, and you call PTI or whatever, and I say I want to buy it, we don't really have anybody who does this. We have people with margin loans, but not. We don't really have people that say, "What's the minimum I can send you for my $100,000 worth of stock?" Well, the minimum would be $50,000, and until that gets to 30%, which means the stock's probably got to be down $25 or so. You don't have to put maybe even 28 bucks. That's when you'll say, hey, you got to either sell some of the stock or send us some more money. But after that, it's dollar for dollar because now you're down to the 30%, and you can't go below that. So
Tom, what's the interest cost on margin?
That's where they make all their money, not us. But that's where like these Robin Hoods and these people. That's where interest is the biggest winner of brokerage firms. Now, we don't get the dough because we're an introducing broker. RBC and IB get it. So if you're borrowing...
Yeah,
you're
but
really
what
borrowing,
is it? What is the...
6.5, 7, depends.
Interest rate.
Yeah, it's not cheap. They vary, 6.5, 7. I think IB probably is the cheapest. But I'm not sure what they are because we don't have any borrowing there, but it's probably 5.5.
So in other words, the stock's got to go up in 1 year. It's got to go up at least... 6% before
you paid half.
Oh, that's right. You're right.
So in theory, but so it's got to go up, 3% for you to break even if you're maxed out.
Well, I don't have this issue since I don't
No, margin. I mean, but now if you make it worse, like they do in Korea and some other places where your initial margin is higher and higher, but in this country, and this is what I've kind of been talking about, and I'm not at all talking about a Korean type problem, but usually it is the canary in the coal mine, right? I mean, it's usually the issue. Yeah. Let me find out real. FINRA, I just did this on Friday. FINRA margin interest. Ours has gone up at a record pace the last 2 months, to the point where you really should be. Let's say I won't be say concerned. I'm not going to say do anything about it. All I'm saying is you should at least be aware of it. Okay. Now the margin statistics as of I'll get a load of this. We're at in March. We were $1,220,000,000,000. All right. April, $1,304,000,000,000.
So that's margin.
That's up $80 billion in 1 month. May, $1,415,000,000,000. So that's another 111. June, $1,502,000,000,000. So in the last 3 months, we're up roughly $300 billion, which is margin debt has grown 25% in 3 months. So I'm never going to get to say, God, sell all stocks. I'm not going to be like Joe Granville in the 80s. But, I mean, that's a very concerning number, that we could have that kind of growth. Because usually it bumps along, like December was $1,225,000,000,000, and in March was $1,220,000,000,000. So basically even. In the last 3 months, it's grown 25%. That's, I don't think I've ever seen that. Certainly with these kind of numbers. I mean, that's insane. Now, what do you do with it? Well, market goes back up. You don't worry about it at all, I guess. But if the market, those numbers are, when you wonder why a Micron can run up $100 or $500 in a couple of months, that's why. Because what you don't have to put up any money. If you own Micron at 100.
Yeah.
You know, when you put up $50,000, all right, and all of a sudden it goes to 200, you now have 150 equity. So you've got excess equity. So if you want to buy another stock at 100, you don't have to put any more money up, right? Now you owe 100. But as long as everything keeps going up, you know, just like this Korean guy that tapped out, you're doing fine. But when it goes back the other way, now you got a problem. So
how much? How much of this? I know that. Really, I was going to say, but it's so segmented into a small group of stocks. In Korea's case, it's the chip makers.
Yeah.
And the minute I say that, I went, well, we're the same. I mean, there's how many stocks are really blowing it out here, Tom? I mean,
some are actually going the other way, but I mean, it's been the Micron ADMs. Those are the guys that are really flying in the last. There's even a bifurcation. In the old, like 2 years ago, if you said tech, you pretty much, probably wrongfully, but you pretty much would group all the seven plus maybe Micron, ADM, you know, those kinds of Intel, you'd group them sort of all together. These were the guys that were, but now it's split really between the users and the sellers of this AI stuff. So you've got the Microns, which sell the memory. It's not really the AI memory, but all the other memory, which has now become way more expensive because of the demand for the AI stuff. You got ADM with their chips. You've got NVIDIA, which really has been steady, which is a little unusual. But you've had Microsoft that does nothing but go down. Tesla's been down.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, if you would have bought Micron and sold Microsoft a year ago, good Lord, you'd be up 500 on the and a Micron and be down 100 on a Microsoft. I mean, it would have been the best pair trade I ever saw, you know. But who thought to do it? I didn't. So, but I mean, there's this huge bifurcation in the fact that it's running up or running down so much. Obviously, it's on a lot of it's on borrowed money, right? Or else you wouldn't see that margin debt go flying up like that. But these are kinds of things you just kind of look at and you go, okay, wait a minute, Am I really happy with these prices or not? And then we're talking about, you know, now this big thing with the AI, I mean, are these guys going to make this money if they're pouring into this stuff?
So it's interesting. I was, I meant to send this to you. There was some guy, I was watching this because I'm always addicted to watching these global social, you know, geopolitical podcasts and everything. But one guy was claiming about AI. He said, there is an analogy here with, of course, the dot-com bubble, which, you know, we all remember. He said, the people that are really, you know, is AI's commoditized. The winners may not be OpenAI or Anthropic and so forth. They may be completely different firms. And I will find it for you. I mean, I'll find it and send it to you. But I've heard this a couple of times now, that as the commodities, not just even the Chinese, with their cheaper models, but, you know, the winners here, it's not ordained that it's going to be Anthropic and OpenAI and the rest of them.
It never is.
And he said it's could be, some of these, you know, for example, and he used the example of Cisco, which I don't know if that's a good example. He says that was one of the, you know, the huge beneficiaries of the dot-com boom of web, whether it's one or two.
It was the hottest stack going.
Yeah. He said it took 20 years for it to recover.
Probably more.
So, I'll say
that. I remember that one like it was yesterday because my buddy Dr. J double-booked a seminar in Washington, New York. And of course, I just happened to be there. So he goes, "Hey, I'm double booked. Can you cover this seminar for me tomorrow?" And I go, "Sure." "Well, where is it?" "Well, it's in Brooklyn." And I go, "All right, I've never been to Brooklyn." And this this is like 2001, so Brooklyn wasn't like it is now. And I go, "By the way, what time?" He goes, "Well, they're starting at 7. And I go, "Okay." So I get out my subway map back when you had maps. I make it over to Brooklyn at, 6:30. it was okay. The subway was right by the hotel. I walk up, and this group is the surliest group I've ever seen. And the seminar was supposed to be, John was going to teach them repair strategies, which, by the way, we do all the time, and I could teach the class tomorrow if I had to. So the guy comes in who's supposed to be doing a seminar. I'm just a guest speaker. And he says, "Well, how was everybody this morning?" "Not a word." "Everybody have a nice weekend?" "Not a word." He turns to me and he goes, "They're all yours." I go, "Okay, then." So I go, "All right, why are we all here?" "Well, we're here because you're supposed to teach us repair strategies." And I said, "Okay, I can do that. That's what I'm here for." And I said, "Okay, what stocks do most people have?" "Let me ask you a question. How many people in the room own Cisco?" "Well, Cisco had just gone from 60 plus to like 6 or 7, like a plain 6 or 7. And I like 90% of the hands go up. And I go, "Well, that might be a tough one." I guess we can do a repair strategy to get you back to 9 or 10, and if that works, maybe 10 or 15. Over the next several years, you might, if the thing creeps back up, you might be able to do all right, but boy, it's going to be a struggle. They were not happy. So finally I said, "I'm an OEX trader. I'm just, doing this because I, know something about options. But what, why did you guys buy it?" They go, "What do you mean? It was the best stock." I said, "Well, it got to like 11 times revenue or 12 times revenue. So the revenue, when the stock was over 60, the revenue was like 6, which, by the way, is not as bad as some of these ones are now. So I've always looked since that day. I've always looked at revenue per share, not necessarily earnings per share, although they are somewhat connected. So,
Palantir, anybody?
No, okay. And they go, what do you mean? The stock was going up every day. I said, I know it was. And there was an outfit in Ohio, in Akron, of all places. I think it was, I don't want to say the name because they might still be around. I don't know if the guy bought the Cisco on the opening, when the place came public or whatever, but they had more Cisco stock than anybody in the world except Cisco management. And the guy wrote it from like you know, 5 or 6 where it came out, all the way to 60 something and all the way back down. Never sold a share, never bought a put, never sold a call. I'm like, what do you think's going to have happen someday? I mean, it couldn't have been a good buy at 60 something as it was at 6. Right?
No.
I mean,
well, it's, you know, these, I think that you got to, yeah, Tom, you see it every day, but never underestimate the power of, I'm not going to use the acronym, but the fear of missing out. Never underestimate
that. Without a doubt.
You know, you sit down there, and I've done it. I won't even talk about my investment in AI in Singapore, the sure thing. And, you know, that only took 15% of my wealth, or 10%. By the way, as an aside, Hynix, and I'm probably mispronouncing it, and Samsung make up 52% of the Korean stock market capitalization. Two companies. That's it. Two companies. Scary.
Well, let me read you a little something. We have Mr. Flanagan. let's see the...
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to get going here because I've got another call at 7, believe it or not.
You know, you're a big shot, you know.
Well, my stomach's getting big.
Well, hang for a second since you brought this up. I call it a panic to be afraid to sell at a profit less than additional profit be lost. The panic which keeps people at roulette tables, the insidious propaganda against quitting a winner, the fear of being taunted by those who held on, all worked together. It became not only a point of pride, but a civic duty not to sell, as if there was a buyer without a seller. This is from the congressional investigations into the crash of 29 in 1930.
I was going to say that sounds like something like it sounds like something from the 29.
But isn't that what you just said?
Yeah.
Have a good one. Do we have Mr. Flanagan? Right.
Yeah, I mean,
hey, John.
You're right, John. I mean, I was thinking that just as you said it. That, it's an extremely emotional or emotionalized response, the fear of missing out.
So,
because you're just dazzled by the possibilities and you're frightened of the opposite of not.
Yeah, let me talk about my instance. I'm seeing all these people we all know of, you know, the people that are involved and, you know, get in early and all that, and they've made, so I'm going to do the same thing, right? I'm not going to miss out. Well, that was a horrifically expensive lesson. And, you know, luckily you have a little bit of cash saved. But, you know, it just gets in there. And then, you know, people have their companies that are not public yet. And, you know, we have a good idea. So you get caught up in this circle of, you know, in my case, it was bullshit. I think that if these individuals had been in Northern California, it might have been a little different. Because, you know, there they can sniff out, you know, they throw money at things, but then, and then they cut their losses. I mean, they know how to work with startups is what I'm trying to say. No, the fear of missing out, I think, is driving a large percentage of what's going on, John.
Yep.
Sorry.
It's always the same emotions. I bought it at 50, it's trading 40. Well, if it was worth 50, it's really got to be worth 40. I need to buy some more. So you average down, right? Which is, which, you know, by the way, if it could actually be a buy at 40. So, you know, it's not like it can't be.
When's the last time we had that as a strat? I remember averaging down in the 90s.
It's still there lurking.
Oh my god!
But you know, but every trade's an independent event. I mean, I can remember a lot of times on the trading floor where if you bought something at $3 and all of a sudden you're getting your ass handed to you, and all of a sudden somebody goes, "You want more at $1.50?" One hand you say, "What am I doing? Averaging down here." The other half is, other thing is, it might actually be a buy at $1.50. You know, see, everything is always an independent event. So,
all right, John, we got to run. All right, talk to everybody later.
But Mr. Flanagan, I mean, it is an independent event. It might actually be worth $1.50. You know, and then you could squeeze your way out at 2.25 at the end of the day. So, I mean, you can't say don't average down. You can't say it's a horrible strategy. You have to look at every single trade you make is an independent event. One doesn't tie to the other. But if you're doing it out of loyalty, no, that's a problem.
Yeah, then it's not really an independent.
Right. It's you refusing to say it wasn't worth 50, it's not worth 40, it's not worth 5. but how many people want to say that to themselves? I mean, I've said on the show a gazillion times that don't think for a second that a trader like me is any smarter when it comes to valuing stuff than maybe you are. I might be dumber. Okay, but the difference is if you trade on a trading floor and you're making 100 trades in a day, 45 of them are clunkers where the other guy knew more than you. You just come to accept that and react to it. I mean, the idea that I bought XYZ at 100 and I got the right newsletter guy and I paid this other guy for his advice or, you know, whoever, Morgan Stanley said it was a buy, whatever it happens to be, and all of a sudden it drops 20%, well, I know I'm right. I had the right guys. You may not be right. The guy you bought it from, the seller, might have been a smarter guy today. But how many people are able to look in the mirror and say, you bleeped up? Well, if you're a trader, you better get used to that. Because it happens all the time. It's not about making the first trade. It's what do you do with it? The winners are easy. It's sort of like baseball. Jimmy, what did Lou Boudreaux say? No matter how bad you are, you're going to win 40 games. And how good you are, no matter how lousy you are, you're going to lose 40. Or how good you are, you're going to lose 40 games is what you do with the other 80. That's the problem. Right? I mean, it's sort of like that in stock and options. But I just sent an email to a client saying it's not about making the initial trade. You'd sure like it if it was a good one and it just was a winner effortlessly. I mean, that would be nice to at least have those once in a while, like maybe, 40% of the time. Then there's some that are just clunkers out of the gate. Then there's some that you can, if you know what you're doing, you can either fix back to a scratch, meaning a break even, or actually turn into a slight profit. That's the skill set, is the ones that aren't the winners. Either massaging them back to being break even, or maybe rolling them up out, doing this, something to them to where you can bring them back from the dark side. Because who the hell thinks that they can make 10 trades a day and they're all right? I mean, I hate to see that ego's got to be way up there. Unless you're trading on inside information, that makes it a little easier, right?
Well, can you tell me and the audience too some kind of way of comparing typical investors in the 1920s to typical investors now? I know it's hard to kind of conceive of a typical investor any time, but certainly margin calls and the inability to meet them were a big factor in the 20s. And it was the thing we were just talking about, the people couldn't afford not to be more fully invested in the market. They were so panicked by the idea of missing out. But there were sophisticated investors, unsophisticated investors then, like there are now, too.
Well, only 7% of the population owned stocks. There were no 401ks. There were no investment accounts. There were no IRAs. So it was nowhere near as widespread of ownership as there is now. And don't forget anybody.
And how about the expertise? I mean, was it?
But don't forget right now you can't borrow an IRA, so there's no margin there. So I mean, when you look at all the stock that say PTI has in people's accounts, I mean, people have in accounts of PTI. It's not our stock; it's yours. I'm going to say at least 40% of our people are IRAs, or people rolled in from 401k. So, but now if you're talking about, the Robinhoods of the world, I'm going to guess that number is totally different. I mean, they probably have 10% of their stuff's IRA, if that. Because I don't know if many people look at Robinhood as their... they might. I don't know. But I'll bet, like a Schwab or Fidelity's probably 50-50 at least. So the margin thing here is not the same as it is in Korea, I don't believe. Because all your retirement accounts, there's no margin there. So it's not as dire, don't think it's... But the fact is, the run-up we've had in the last 3 months is something to have your eye on. Like I said, don't go out and sell the market today because of it, type of thing, but it's something to look at. And you should look at what happened in Korea as, let's say, an educational experience, not as a trading thing. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
But when you start seeing, five or six little bombs in the air at the same time, you might want to say, The thing you're also forgetting, Jan, is not forgetting, you haven't mentioned, is people refuse to take huge profits because they don't want to pay any taxes, which I think, I mean, I don't usually take a shot at retail investors, but I will here. If I had a dime for every trade somebody should have made because they had to pay taxes, I'd be the richest man in the country. And I'm serious. God, I bought this stock at 50, it's trading 100. Would you buy it at 100? Oh, hell no. Maybe you should sell it. Oh, God, no, I don't want to pay the taxes. Okay, then. There you go. That and the fact that in the other wrinkle in the last 10 years, and not so much now, you know, because there is some interest to be made. I think we can go to the, what's the short-term rate? We probably go to the Treasury for somebody 4.5. For a while, it was 5. Maybe 3-something. But, I mean, you do get some interest. It's not like it's zero. So you have a lot of, I'll use the term, elderly people, not elderly, mature people, that are all in stock. I mean, if you were to slink back 20 years, you would say, okay, if somebody's retired in 75-ish, you know, the old rule was, you know, you're down to, you know, 40% stock, something percent bonds, 20% cash. Well, when there was nothing in the bonds and nothing in the cash, you have an extreme amount of people, I'll say, of retirement that are not working anymore that are 80, 90, 95% in stock. That to me is somewhat of a danger. Now, if it's protected, you know, some kind of put, some, you know, type of thing like that, if you're in some kind of a protected program, that carves some of the risk out. You know, maybe depending on what stuff you buy and how much you're paying for it, you could take a lot of the risk out. But if you're just playing, I mean, you would never have seen, you know, when we were doing this, you know, when we first started the Protected Index program in 97, you rarely saw somebody who came in who was 75 that was all stock. But now you do. Because for 10 years, what are you making in the bank? 0.5%? What's the point? There was no alternative. So you push people out on the risk-reward curve to spots where maybe, historically, they didn't want to be. Now, for the last 10 years, if you had all your money in Apple or Micron, you did pretty damn good, right? So, or in NVIDIA. So it's not like, you know, if you had the right stocks, you did fine. So it's kind of a jumble of advice, right? And it's a jumble of experiences. Some people have stock from their places they worked that they've 90% in, well, say for instance in Exxon. We had a couple of people that were at a bullet. Well, since the war started, and you know we had a couple of skirmishes before that, the price of oil went up, and the price of Exxon has done pretty well. Same way with Chevron. But it was a total dead dog for like a really long time, and you know we have a lot of people in the, I'll get a chart of the XLE. Now the XLE is, so I'm not talking about an individual stock. I think if you went back, how far back can we go? If you went back, let's say max. I mean the XLE was, in 2014 for God's sake was 50, and now with this huge run up this year, it's still 58. But at one point, in 2020, it was down to like 15. So if you'd have bought oil stocks in the early 2010, 2011, 2012 age, over you're barely up, and for a long time you were down. So it's not just, you know, you can't just say, you know, Dad left me this stock; it's a good one. Some stocks have gone nowhere. I mean, one of the ones that that I always kind of liked was it's one of the biggest oil companies around. Let me see if I get a graph of it. You know, I'm not beating up on him. Was Schlumberger, the old slob, and this was the third biggest stock in that index, and this stock is trading 51. God's sake, these guys were 150 in 1981. They got to 110 in 97. They got to 126 in 2006. You know, they got to 109 in August of 2014. They got down to $17, John, in 2020, and now they're back up to 51. So what if that was your, you know, Pops had left you that one? Good luck. And they're, yeah. And they're, you know, they were the third. They weren't an oil company, an oil service provider, but they were. It was Exxon, Chevron, and then these guys in terms of how big they were. So you can't just look at the averages either. You have to look at individual stocks. So, I mean, it's concentration issues can either be the best thing in the world. What if you had if you're 100% Apple from the day it was $5? Well, guess what? I'm riding on your yacht this week, right? But what if you pick Schlumberger? You know, you're not going anywhere, are you? I mean, maybe you get some dividends once in a while, but that's about it. So this is more difficult than the pontificators and TV will let you know. I guess is my summary. Is that much of a summary or what?
Yeah, well, it related to that. I mean, I in my limited viewpoint, in the past, you know, if a company was really, you know, booming, you know, stock was soaring and people were getting in on the deal, you know, hand over fist. That translated to, you know, expansion, to creating jobs, hiring people at the wazoo, and maybe, you know, the next time around in another cycle, you let everybody go and start all over again. But to me, it looks like any of the expansion now, at least, you know, the stocks are going anywhere, is very hard to connect to growth in job creation, if, you know, or any kind of expansion in the traditional, you know, definition. So what does that mean for, you know, well, you know, long-term prosperity, I guess, for one thing, and when it comes to wealth building, you know, are you really building wealth if the company that you're invested in, or maybe heavily invested in, isn't creating prosperity for anybody except themselves?
John, these are the questions that we talk about every day from a different direction on the show. I mean, I think you're well aware of that. It's the difference, and that's why I'm glad she was back again on Wednesday last week. Larissa, she brings stuff up that she's a very bright lady. I don't even know that she realizes how deep some of the stuff she says is. I mean, maybe it's just because of all the other days of the week we're kind of asking the questions, and then she comes out and kind of focuses some things, even though I don't even know that she knows she's doing. When I say that, I'm not saying it's a random thing of a 5-year-old. It surely isn't. But what the ramifications are of the stuff she says? Because how could she possibly? Because the stuff is so incredibly deep, what she talks about. I mean, we're going to have numbers today. We're going to have these tariff things going on, and all the crap that you're getting out of this administration, by the way, which is the same as the crap we got out of the last one and the one before that. At some point, how much can you diversify your population? I mean, like, you know, Carl, you know, he talks about some stuff that maybe some other people don't even know what's going on, and it's hard to put your finger on it. But if for instance, Microsoft, I'll just pick a name, if those guys are devious enough to be making all kinds of money, or Apple, and instead of hiring people, and I have no, I'm in a total different than some of the other people on the immigration stuff, in terms of somebody's here, wants to become an American, does some stuff, goes to school here. I don't really have a problem with that, because that's how we all got here, okay? But the idea that somehow or another firms of that magnitude are firing people here, grabbing people from overseas in some sort of an indentured servant contract, where they can't go down the block and get another job. They're not really citizens. They got to go back. But they can rent people from other places that essentially are slaves. You know, well-paid slaves, but they're slaves. Or they, I guess they go back on their own, so they're not, you don't own the person, but you do in terms of their employment here. You own that. I don't know what you want to call them. So it's not a slave, but it's something. The fact that people are doing that, I think, is appalling. I mean, how many people even, I don't know the magnitude of it or whatever, but it, to me, it has nothing to do with the immigration part where you should shoot the person. How do these companies manage to weasel this kind of a deal out of our government? And who are the morons we have there? And how much are they getting paid off by these guys?
Well, and a lot of it is fraud.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't seem to be. It seems to be, you know.
I mean you can say you've advertised for, you know, a worker and you can't find anybody in the job pool who's born here or a citizen or here legally, so you have to go beyond that job search, which is totally fraudulent from what I've been able to gather. I mean, it's easy to lie about that stuff.
Yeah.
You put up a fake job posting and then say nobody.
Well, I don't think there's even a posting. I think it's bring people over.
Right, yeah. It doesn't have to go to that stage. So that, I mean, that's one of the reasons. Now, if there were enforcement of
Well, Jan, what is, I mean, I'm asking you, I hope you know, because I don't know if that one is. If somebody comes here from, it was with Chinese people, but say somebody comes here from India, they go to school at the University of Illinois, they get their degree, they do well. Now, do they go back to India and somebody retains their name, they bring them in again on this other HB1 thing, or do they just graduate Illinois and say, you know what, I'm going to apply for citizenship and I'm going to get a job here? Now, that I wouldn't necessarily have a problem with, would you?
No.
But the idea that somebody brings them back and now you own the guy for 2 years or a lady, how did that even become legal?
Well, it isn't, and it shouldn't be, and it's never supposed to be.
Well, it's one thing to have seasonal workers, I think, come into California from Mexico and do something for a couple months because you need them in the agricultural area, and then because I don't think, I guess you could put a help wanted sign up, but you're not getting anybody else to want to do that. I mean, but this is not a shot at Hispanics, because the Irish did that here. They did canals, they dug canals, and they made railroads, right? The Chinese did that here. People are always willing to work harder sometimes to get here, seemingly. The idea that if you just would have paid enough on the railroad that somebody from Astor Street here or Upper East Side in New York was going to show up on the railroad, I don't buy that, do you? And people here have a very negative opinion. Not that it's dirty or beneath them or something, but they have a very low opinion of blue-collar work in factories and stuff because everybody who did it got screwed, laid off or something, right? And then everybody, as the late Bill Moriarty said one day, he goes, I asked him, and he says, on the South Side, no parent who had those kinds of a job, even though they might have made a nice living and actually enjoyed it, wanted their kids doing it because they knew how shifty the ownership was. They knew the manufacturing was leaving, and the last thing you want to do is be an out-of-work welder at age 50 with no other skill set. So they couldn't wait for their kids to go to college and not have to put up with that crap from these companies. It didn't have anything to do with the fact that welding was a dirty job and you had to take a shower when you got home, I don't think. But anybody who has that mindset, you don't necessarily... You'd love to have the carpenter skills. I mean, I have the fact that I don't mind. I could be an electrician, well, a half-assed electrician. I mean, I like to have these kind of skills just because I can model something. I kind of know what I'm doing. But why would I want to be an iron worker and say, oh, by the way, there's no buildings going up for 10 years? I mean, it's because anybody who's in that industry has that history, right?
Right.
So the idea was I don't want to be freezing my ass off only to be saying I'm laid off the next day with nothing to feed my family. I want to have a job, and white-collar jobs promised a healthier but more stable future. It wasn't like they were I don't think, because a lot of people like to work outdoors. I didn't mind it either. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on here. But last week, did you hear the conversation between me and Larissa regarding her class and tariffs?
No.
I'm still stunned about that one. But this weekend, as I was talking to people, I said, she teaches freshmen and juniors. I said, if you were to put, showing my age, walk up to the blackboard and write the word tariff, and you asked students in your class, and you picked, the example I always use because it was on my final at the University of Chicago, you're going to put a $5,000 tariff on Mercedes-Benzes, one car from one country. Is your class capable? I mean, maybe not, because, I was a grad student and, stuff, of walking that through. All the different variables, all the different reactions of the importer, the dealership, the exporter, meaning Mercedes, the competition, who gets the money, how it works, who actually gets paid what check. Can anybody walk it through for the next 5 years, both stock and flow? And she goes, not a one of them. I said, so what if you put it on the board and said, what about tariffs? She goes, it would immediately be a pure six argument, or whatever adjective she used, all come down political lines. If you like Trump, it's a great idea. If you don't, it's not. But she said, not one person would actually be able to walk it through like you can, nor do they care. But they have their opinion. I sense that might be the answer, but I sure as hell didn't want to hear that, Jen.
And that's with, you know, more people going to college than ever.
Yeah, but it also, in this world, all you have to do is have an X account, and your opinion is as good as anybody else's.
You got a following.
Yeah, you got something. And you don't really need, you can read four sentences regarding a criminal, and by the way, you're already the jury member. Even though the jury member sits there for 3 weeks and listens to testimony and evidence. No, you got it all figured out. You don't need to do that, right? Why would you? You got it all figured out. I mean, that is pretty scary. Don't you think you ought to be able to work your way through it, at least have some kind of an idea before you open your mouth?
Well, it's taken a toll in families, you know, the family structure or the lack of family structure in lots of different ways. I mean, one of the, like, you know, the things behind the push for free college, you know, everybody should go to college, which is, you know, certainly in this kind of climate, it's an asinine idea. White collar jobs are going the way of the dodo. If all you're doing is preparing people for white collar jobs, you know, something's wrong with that picture. But now you've got an ever larger proportion of college students who are women, and they're, when they come out, they don't want to marry a welder and show them off to all their girlfriends. This is not what they went to college for. So they're looking for an ever smaller.
They want to show up with a guy like you or Jimmy and say, "Here's my person," because you guys went to college.
Here's my trophy husband.
Here's my trophy husband. God. They might want to rethink the welder.
Yeah. But you know, the ultimate, you know, the end of that story is they don't get married.
Yeah.
You never find a guy who's worthy of them. Because there's fewer men coming out with college degrees in proportion to the women, and the ones who are coming out aren't making a lot of money.
Well, the only thing that when
elders are an ever increasingly needed group of people, but they're an ever scarcer group too. So we got a real mess on our hands.
The thing that I bristle a little bit when you, being a college professor, kind of badmouth the college thing. I'd like if we can. And I always go back at you, or not so much Kevin, because I always go back at you by saying the college experience that it's turned into, our college experience, and instead of being, I'm going to say, $15,000-$16,000 over 4 years, is $250,000. I'm not going to justify necessarily that at that price, but I hope none of the listeners get the idea that you or Kevin or anybody else is against, quote, education. Because I don't want a populace that, if a president says the tariffs are on the other people, where they believe the guy. Because that isn't true. I would hope that people would know that. Or some legal question that you should say, God, everybody should know that. And they don't. I mean, my mother, I mean, I don't think she died when she was 82 or 3. She was 79. She's still taking classes and saying exams at night. She never went to college. But so I think that the idea that people should be curious enough to get all the education they want, or the idea whether you read or whether you do something, the idea that you're going to shut yourself off to learning, that's not my, just because you don't want to go to Notre Dame at $80,000 a year doesn't mean that you shouldn't learn something someplace. Because I don't want a country of dumb people, because you get taken advantage of, I think. So I don't know how I separate those two, whether you go to a junior college first, whether you do something else, whether you wait, you go 2 years afterward, or you do whatever it is. I mean, I'm not espousing the $300,000 deal or more than that, the $400,000 4 years. I think it's way too expensive. But by the same token, I don't want a bunch of dummies walking around either. And if you're a welder, I don't see any reason why you can't know accounting and why you can't know how to trade stock. I mean, do you?
Oh, no, absolutely not. And, you know, I'm not bad mouthing education, but you're far from it. But I do see, you know, and I can see this myself as a retired teacher, that, you know, towards the end of my career, I was teaching less and less to ever less qualified students. And I think that was people following the drum beat that, well, everybody, if you can't go to college, then there's something wrong with you, which is, I mean, I never bought into that, that everybody had to go to college, or that it was some kind of badge of dishonor not to go to college. College always, you know, had an elitist ring to it, and that's why people, you know, aspired to getting their kids out of their, you know, family's, you know, class structure and into another one. So it was considered a positive thing, and, you know, the work ethic, you know, kind of driving this too, that this was a way of bettering yourself and a way of, you know, making life easier for your descendants than we had it as your parents. And, you know, that was in my family too, and everybody else's family that I knew. But at the end of the day, when looking back on this, and I've been out of education now for 13 years, I mean, I still keep up the trends as much as I can, but I can see that there was a real problem, you know, starting about 2005, 2006, where the quality of high school graduates collapsed. And
why is that?
I think it's, you know, No Child Left Behind, the stuff that, you know.
Yeah, but this happened in schools that had nothing to do with that.
Well, yeah, but it was curriculum driven. You know, this is what you, in order to be accredited, in order to, you know, get grant money, whatever, this is what you have to show that you're using as your educational tools. So it was all, you know, grammar thrown out the window, phonics thrown out the window, whole language approach. Just kind of get the drift of something. Guess at the words meaning. Don't bother to
learn. John, how much of it, I don't want to spend too much time, how much of it is just the teachers? I have, you know, a couple teachers in the family, and I think they're pretty darn bright, but they'll take, you know, a week off during the year, or, you know, obviously if kid problems, you know, well, the kid's sick, I'm staying home. I don't recall anybody ever, unless the guy was on death's door, nobody took a day off. You had the same person all the time. There was never any substitute teacher for a week crap or anything. I'm not saying substitute teachers are bad, but there was never any of that. And if you did, the principal came and taught. I mean, is it the way high schools are run?
Well, that's the private school way of doing it. That was my experience too. I can remember vividly the days in whatever grade where I had a substitute teacher, and it wasn't every year. And it was never more than once per year, where even a lay teacher, you know, none, always showed up. But even where a lay teacher couldn't make it in, and you had some other teacher, the principal, or, you know, a qualified parishioner in our parish who could teach and be happy to come in and teach geography and spelling for one day. But I remember those days were so out of the ordinary to my grade school experience. And it never happened in high school.
Well, John, how can you take a population, however we get there, how can you look at this tariff fiasco the first time through and have the guy drag up another law to do it again? How does anybody not look in the mirror and say, we're not really doing this? Man, we just did this. We sucked money out of everybody's pocket, including mine, and now it was wrong. We're giving the money back to the people who took it from me, but I'm not getting any. But now we're going to do it again. How does anybody think that the Supreme Court just screwed my guy or whatever? How does anybody think that makes any sense? I mean, how much are they going to drag it out of your pocket? And when are we going to get to a point where 300 million people look in the mirror and go, a tariff is a tax on me? Why can't... I mean, there's very few absolutes in this world, but that's one of them. And yet... If you don't, you know, if you believe certain people, it can't be on me. The Brits are paying this tax. No, it may work its way through, because if the person who tells you that, it may work its way through that they drop their prices to stay competitive. To a sense, they share the pain a little bit, which I think most of the people who would be arguing with me wouldn't even know that. They could conceivably share the pain a little bit by lowering their prices to stay competitive. And the people here could raise their prices, and they're supposed to be American, right, and keep their prices the same. That doesn't happen, does it? Why at some point here can't we say, no, we're not doing this again, or what are we doing here? If somebody were to put a 10% sales tax nationally, I would think they'd get drummed out of office by God knows what. Yet it's the same damn thing, and everybody goes along with it. I mean, what why have we become so collectively ignorant?
Well, we've been taught by the globalists to think that tariffs, you know, that word should be out of the dictionary. We shouldn't even recognize that concept for what it is. It's a way of an individual nation dealing with political and economic problems that it perceives, and it knows pretty well who's behind the problems, and they use this as a means to an end to get political and economic leverage that they can't get any other way. But the globalists have trashed the term and the idea so much, and the trashing is alive and well, that, you know, if people understand it at all...
Who's a globalist, Reagan?
Well, I would include him in that group of people who were opposed to it. But it's not just people in this country. It's worldwide globe. This is why, you know, Trump has pissed off so many people. And I would say, you go. You keep pissing them off, too.
Why?
If a nation doesn't have the ability to respond to what it sees as inequities or closed markets or whatever else, and you give it all that power to the EU or the International Criminal Court or some other obnoxious entity, then we are finished as a country. So
I would never remove
the World Trade Organization.
I would never remove.
Don't get me started on that.
Okay, but I would never remove the ability to put a tariff on some place that really was doing something dastardly. I would always retain that, but that's not what we're seeing here. I mean, we're seeing a total misunderstanding of how the whole economic systems of the world work. I mean, if you were to give our president a quiz and say, if there's an island somewhere that has a spice on it that everybody wants, and we buy it from them, so now we have a trade deficit. Well, it's all we do is buy this one spice. Now they got dollars and we got the spice. He would say they're screwing us. Yet they're not. We're buying something from them. And they're going to turn around and use our dollars to buy God knows what from France, wine or someplace. And somebody in France is going to turn around and use the dollars to buy something from Britain, who's going to use the dollars to buy something here. That's how trade's supposed to work. Unless you found out for some reason that this island was screwing with something. And I'm kind of with Carl that if all of a sudden they're polluting the hell out of the place or using child labor, I wouldn't be opposed to using some sign of a tariff against that. But that's not what we're doing here. We're talking about a tax, because it's
a means to an end, Tom.
It isn't if it's 60 countries.
This is where
how do you know Trump's, that? Because he told you so?
No, I objected to Trump saying this is going to be a moneymaker because of all the money we rake in. That isn't why you have tariffs. It isn't to raise revenue. It's to extort behavior that you can't extort any other way.
But we
Or influence, like you say.
So do you think that he could prove that all 60 countries were putting a tariff on every single one of them was screwing us?
As part of a bigger system, I think, yes.
Why?
I mean, I couldn't make the case right now in front of you today.
Well, I mean,
maybe not even for one single country.
But I mean, we put a tariff.
I know that the strategy, I look at who's trashing the concept, and those are the people that I totally distrust.
Well, I trash the way it's being used. I mean, because I'm one of these guys that actually looks at I think I told you this, it looks at the first time they went flying out there, we put a big tariff on Luxembourg. And I said, okay, what do we import from Luxembourg? Now, I know you're not there yet. You're still a young man. What do we import from Luxembourg?
Wasn't it false teeth or something?
Yeah. Those guys are screwing us.
You know, if you just think of it as that, this is a wrong-headed tariff right here. It's also about who's looking at what the U.S. is doing and setting up the scenario that maybe I'm next. And it isn't like I can point to anything that's an imbalance of any kind that a tariff might fix. I can't think that far ahead.
Well, okay.
But maybe somebody is using this as an entirely different method of extorting behavior, and not from Luxembourg.
All right, the issue comes down to who, when people are at blame here, when people are blaming other people, let's find out who are the people are doing the dastardly stuff. We have people, we know who they are, big companies that have moved production overseas because they can get child labor and other stuff, right? We know that. I mean, it's caused a real problem here. correct? I mean, look at Apple, all the stuff in China, all these, I mean, we can go down the list, right? There's a difference between a place that economically has more labor than we do, that is willing, when I say willing to work, because there's more of it, there's a bigger supply, the price is going to be a little bit lower. Now, that doesn't mean that we want people that are 14-year-old working in sweat houses. We don't want that. Okay, but, I mean, there's always going to be some place that has a labor advantage versus we have a power advantage. We have other, well, we used to have a power advantage. We have a land advantage. We have other kinds of advantages here that we can bring to play why we're more efficient in some stuff and other people might be in other stuff. Okay, but, and I have no issue with, if we think that Apple is only going to China and paying off political people, which I think they probably are, and everybody over there is, so that the people are still 14 years old making nothing in a place, I got a problem with that. And if there's a way where we can somehow even that up by tariffs, I could see some of that. I mean, you know, make the case for me. But the idea that somehow or another we're gonna just have these blanket tariffs, which are a tax on people here, and just hope that one of these days our other goals are accomplished without even telling people what the goals are, you know, I don't know. Plus, we have this other issue that for years and years there's a difference, and I really shudder, and I, you know, a lot of the people on the show will talk about, well, we have this deficit with this country. I go, wait a minute. We have a floating exchange rate. It's not really a deficit. It's a deficit on the trade end, but it's not a current account deficit. Well, what does that mean? It means that if we have a trade deficit with, say, UK, traditionally, the U.S. is overspent based on themselves. How many people, other than maybe Clinton for a little while, and Carl even disputes that, we've run a deficit here for, God, how long? 60, 70 years? And the people who have made up that deficit is the people from overseas are buy our stuff. Well, if Trump, in his, I think, very limited knowledge, cuts that off, where's he going to get the dough? I'm not saying it's the greatest of systems, but it has been a system. And every time you do, who's the Chinese guy that said no man can do one thing? You have to have some kind of idea of what it is when you do one thing, how it represents somewhere else. And, you know, I remember in the auto business, you know, we didn't want, the big three here got so sloppy. You remember what a car was like in the late 60s? If you had it 3 years, it looked like the car in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, right? It totally rusted out. It was a piece of crap in a lot of ways. So the Japanese came over here, and all of a sudden, they made the people here make a better car, right? Because of their competition, because there wasn't any here. Now, we never should have let, what did we have in the 30s, John? How many car makers do we have? 50? In the 20s, we went down to three. Yeah, we went down to three. So we made a cartel, just like we're doing in a lot of other businesses right now, right? Just like we're doing in medical care. And the same result always happens. I mean, right now, what? We have people charging $45,000 for chemotherapy here, and you get a $5,000 in Europe. Because guess what? It's a monopoly here, and maybe it isn't there. So, I mean, these things all have repercussions, and they're all stuff that we should be thinking about, but you can't just have this one kind of focus on one thing. And I wouldn't take tariffs out of my arsenal if I was president. If somebody really did something that was dastardly, or if somebody we knew would be working over there was age 12, I'd tariff the hell out of them and say, well, okay, this is why we're doing it, and by the way, it's just you, and knock it off. Or if somebody had a plant in Texas, and we gave them some grief about pollution, and they turned around and went on the other side of the Rio Grande and poured it in, well, we got even that up, don't we? I don't have a problem with that, do you? Happens.
You know, for me, I mean, tariffs are a way of clarifying who's an ally and who's an enemy, or a potential ally and potential enemy. And the tariffs, in history anyway, have always been a tool to be used against an ally. You know, it's a trading partner, somebody who already has some kind of, you know, common, you know, enterprise that you're seeking leverage to increase it or decrease the other person's or whatever, but it's on the surface a friendly, normal relationship. But of course, it's maybe anything but that. And I think tariffs are a political tool primarily. At least I would say that's how they should be.
Why can't I?
Because only if you can affect some, you know, political drift in another country to see something from your vantage point, you haven't gained any leverage by imposing a tariff. If it's just going out there and somebody's paying more up the wazoo for some product ABC, nothing changes because nothing has to change, then of course, I think that's maybe an ill advice.
I guess my question is, and this is a political one, and from people on one side or the other, I am not saying that none of what you're talking about could possibly be true. Okay, I'm not going to say that, because in some cases it might be true. Okay, but what I have problems with, and people with different political setting from me, I look at this just economically. Right now, on day one, it's a tax on our people by our guy that should be coming out of Congress. I'm not saying all of it's not justified. I'm not saying some countries aren't screwing us. I'm not saying any of that. All I'm saying, what I know for sure is, it's a tax on our people to be justified, basically country by country, and done very, you know, I'll say, you know, with rigor, with some sort of analysis. Here's why this country's screwing us. Here's why I'm doing it. If somebody did that, but I know out of the gate, it's a tax on you and me. And why do people give people in government, it just happens to be Republican this time, it could have been somebody else, why do you give them the break that somehow they're a higher intellect than you or I, and it's something other than that? Why can't it just be a tax first? Because maybe that's what it is. Because right now, tomorrow, you and I are paying. The other stuff may be true, it may not be true, but one thing I know is true, we're paying.
Well, I think we pay until we get whatever solution.
What makes you think the guy's been talking about taxes, tariffs since 1982? If the man stayed in office 50 years, we'd always have tariffs, because that's the way he wants to tax the people without having to have a regular tax law. And because, you know, he spent all the money he sold, supposedly saved on the I'm saying, John, it is that first, is all I'm saying. It is that. I mean, it's just like if they raised the sales tax and said, okay, we're gonna have a national sales tax of 15%, and we're gonna do all these good things with it. What would you think? Wait a minute. All I know is I paid 15%, and maybe we'll get the good things, and maybe we won't. All I'm saying is a tariff's the same thing. And people, somehow or another, think it's totally different, and it's some sort of mental thing, you know, Trump versus UK, and he's just trying to make a deal. No, it's not. Out of day one, it's a tax. And I can't seem to get that, you know, tax may be justified, maybe not, but it seems like the tax is coming first and the justification later, is all I'm saying.
Well, I think the tariffs, you know, to a great extent have been responses to what Trump and other people have seen as, you know, a turning away, you know, by these nations from, you know, their obligations in NATO or in, you know, whatever defense responsibilities we think they should have, or just their political alignment with us. And I think that's the case with Canada and the tariffs. I mean, Canada's, you know, every day with Carney seems to be, you know, pointing, you know, an accusatory finger at the U.S. for some, you know, objection, and aligning himself more closely with Europe and China.
It was his response. Well, how does he deal with this buffoon? We put a 50% tariff last week on cars. Guess what? Those are our cars we're making there. We put a 50% tariff on dairy. We import $350 million, and we export $1.1 billion. How are we getting screwed?
Well, I don't know if we're getting screwed there, but we're getting screwed elsewhere.
Where the tariffs are going.
And this is where I say, you know, it's not as simple as, you know, this is, you know, one industry, one product, one company that, you know, wants a bigger market somewhere else, and we got to do this, and we're going to balance.
But if you put 50%,
it's bigger than that, Tom, and it should be.
Well,
bigger.
No, why give him that grease when he just lied to you about the damn thing? He puts a tariff. If you put a tariff on Mercedes Benzes, because you hate Germany, I at least get it, okay? But if you put a 50% tariff on Silverados coming out of Toronto, and people here are gagging an $85,000 pickup, where does that go? I'm just asking you the intellectual side. Where does that go? Is that what you want? Do you want to pay $120,000 for the pickup tomorrow?
Well, I won't pay it. That's
well, somebody,
you
know, is
my privilege. I don't have to pay anything for a product that's unaffordable for me. This is, you know, this is
okay,
I don't have to go
there. But I'm saying these are things. If you go to a Home Depot lately, you want to put a 50% tariff on lumber from Canada, for God's sake. Now, maybe you screw the Canadians. Maybe they export to China. I don't know. But the fact is, I know tomorrow morning you and I are paying for it.
Kevin just texted, you know, let's bring Hamiltonian economics into discussion.
Well, I agree. Yeah, but now Kevin's and other people's job right now is to find some shred of logic to what the man's doing. All I'm saying is, I sit there and I 50% tariff on dairy. Okay, I kick up. By the way, how much do we import on dairy, and how much do they import?
I would say at some level, Tim, it doesn't matter.
Okay, that's fine. We're just going to believe him no matter what.
I'm saying it doesn't matter how much beer or how much is affected by this. It's showing a willingness to, you know, stick our nose in somebody's face and say, cut this blankety blank out.
But you never knew.
It's a tool, Tom.
I'm saying
to an end. It shouldn't be an end in itself. It should be a means.
Was it obvious to John Flanagan that Canada was an enemy until this guy told you?
It was an enemy when Trudeau was in there.
Well, you didn't like Trudeau.
It's been drifting leftward and crazy
for
the last 20, 30 years.
Did you know they were an economic enemy before he told you?
I knew they were, you know, not the ally that we thought they were for a long time.
Okay. You know how much...
And you listen to their political debate. Listen to the crazy wing of their party.
They don't agree with Trump, neither do I. So how much does the average American buy of Canadian goods?
I don't really care.
Okay, well, it's $1,500.
It's not about you.
It's not about the facts. It's just about the average Canadian buys $9,000 of U.S. goods. The average American buys.
That isn't the only way we get screwed, Tom.
But they don't treat Trump. I'm trying to figure out where I'm getting screwed. I mean, you know, if I am, I'm willing to do anything, but I can't figure it out.
Well, you know, they pay zero for defense. They don't enforce their border. They are closely aligned now.
They pay zero. Zero is the real number. By the way, they helped us out in Afghanistan, didn't they? In Iraq, what'd that get them?
Well, that's 20 years ago. You know?
Okay, what'd that get them? We never should have been there.
Didn't seem like they were making any long-time commitment either.
They didn't get any of the oil. They weren't getting any of the oil we were going to get anyway. What do you think of today's...
They're not paying anything for defense, Tom.
Nothing. Not a dime. They don't have any planes. They don't have any troops. They don't have any ships. Do we even know? Or are we taking one guy's word for it that can't tell the truth if he did it by accident?
Well, they get the benefit of having an undefended border. Well, they ride it to the max.
Well, you know, somewhere along the line... I don't disagree that we have spent a lot of money, but if you were to ask why presidents starting...
Well, we've wasted a lot of money and energy treating people around the world as if they're our best buddy, and, you know, oh, this is just, you know, somebody...
What makes you think we just didn't want
to... We're not pay attention to that, and it should be a different policy.
What makes you think that we didn't have... And you're old enough to know this. What makes you think we didn't spend a lot of money to have people in Europe because we wanted to control Europe?
Well, after World War II, we had to control. Somebody had to control it, and it was us or the Russians.
Okay,
that had
right,
been stalemate for a long time.
We wanted people in Okinawa because we wanted to control the Far East. We would not have been happy if Canada all of a sudden had a...
After getting burned by Pearl Harbor and, you know, whatever else, I think we were justified.
Okay, well, I'm just saying we...
And the Japanese certainly benefited from it.
We did this because we wanted
to. We could have run roughshod like they did in Manchuria, and we didn't.
I'm not debating any of that stuff. I'm just saying, well, we did it because we wanted to.
We did it because we had to. Somebody had to.
Okay. Well. Anyway.
What did our average citizen get out of the financing of the Marshall Plan or everything else? That took a toll on the economy.
I think we made a lot.
I would say it was money well spent.
We made a lot of customers. A lot of people made a lot of money redoing.
Well, eventually, yeah, but, you know. We were in so much better shape that we didn't feel.
Well, the problem is, I think you got to separate a little bit. Who's the we? A lot of people here, made a real lot of dough doing all this stuff. A lot of people are making a lot of money on what's going on in Iran, too, which is unfortunately not you and me. It's like a lot of people are going to make a lot of money in Lollapalooza. It's not going to be you and me. We're just not part of this we that I see.
Well, it's always been true.
I know, but it's getting a little, you know, I had a discussion with my nephew yesterday. Look at all these great festivals. I said, okay, they're fine. I think people should be able to go someplace and enjoy themselves. But every time you do something, somebody gets disenfranchised. They can't go home. They can't get an Uber. You can't get to their house. Streets get closed. Somebody else has to go somewhere else, take somebody else's time. Yeah, well, they should just, you know, so what? Other people, I said, okay, but before you say so what, there's people that are benefiting. Everybody should know the list of people that are benefiting, what the price is, and then you get the inevitable, well, the city's making money. Okay, the city. Do you think the city's making a profit on it? Well, yeah. Now, do you know that or not know that? Or are you just, you know, whipping stuff out of your pie hole? I mean, how many people realize was the first three Lollapaloozas, the deal with the city was, they didn't even get the city tax, did they?
No, well,
and finally, maybe it was more than 3 years. Well, but I mean, yes, but they didn't even get the city tax that goes on a ticket if you go to a movie or a Cub or a Sox game. Whoever did it, now the city's eating the police stuff. I don't know who puts up the fences. I mean, maybe they pay for all that stuff. The first year, they totally wrecked the park, and then finally they got money out of them. So the question is, the whole list at the end of the day, who's making what? Is it just some private people? Is it the same person who puts up the hot dog stands and the portalettes at every single one of these things? Do they contribute to the mayor? Do they contribute to Trump? Do they contribute to the governor? If those 10 people make all the dough, the city doesn't get a dime, and everybody else is inconvenienced, I'm going to say maybe we should rethink this. Now, if it turns out the city actually does make some money and it pays for this and it's a contribution to the police's pension fund and, oh, by the way, everybody has a nice time, I can roll with it. But I never really know, do I?
Well, you assume the opposite.
Why would I ever assume anything proper? Anywhere, and what level of government we're at now? Why would I assume anything proper? Without knowing that,
you know, we have such a legacy, Tom. You know, when the geopolitics looked a little simpler, when there was Russia and China, you know, bogeyman, and everybody else, and we all, you know, seem to be on the same page about a lot of things, and that changed, you know, quite a while ago. But nobody really wanted to take, you know, stock of how much it had changed and what the end product might look like. And now we have, you know, a Europe that is just, you know, a mess. And they're the ones lecturing us on we should be doing.
Well, it's a mess because our guy has told us it's a mess. Is it really a mess compared to us? What's a defined mess?
I mean, Germany has no
energy
policy that makes any sense. They don't have, you know, secure borders. They don't have an immigration policy of any kind that I can see.
Why do we care about their immigration policy?
Because it's taken a toll on a trading partner and it should be a military ally too.
Maybe Trump should run them too. He'd figure it out.
Well, I mean, they're not the ally they used.
But why does anybody believe anything that our people say about somebody? Nobody's ever been there. How do I know?
We're talking about, and you and I are fighting. This is exactly what people at the World Economic Forum are just, you know, angel choirs are singing because they got everybody fighting about stuff.
Well, some people are making all the money.
It should never reach this point, and all they do is stoke the flames and sit back and laugh at both sides.
Well, with the plutocracy, we should be worried a little about that. We're not, are we?
Well, I mean, we're fighting, I guess, as hard as we can without firing missiles at everybody.
Okay, but we're fighting what? Are we fighting the people that are greasing Trump and making all the money?
We're fighting a mindset that's, you know, it's creeping into this country.
Are we fighting the kids that bought into the drone manufacturer and now got a huge drone contract? Are we fighting that? And who's here making all the dough, Jen? It's not you and me. Clients are doing pretty good, but especially today. But I mean,
this is what munition makers and warmongers in history always did. They sell weapons to both sides.
Well, yeah. So what do you? We got a big rally today. You want to sell it or not? You want to sell Chevron Texaco's down $5?
I'm afraid to sell.
You're afraid to sell. It might go further, huh?
Well, I'm afraid for this going to like make my neighbors sell too.
I'm not talking about your house, about your stocks.
No, I mean stocks. I mean, well, word of mouth gets around.
Well, we're gonna have Nancy.
It's time to sell.
We're gonna have Nancy. Let's talk about. Let's talk about some, you know, the housing prices and so forth.
I'm on.
Well, we got to do a quick break because we got to tell everybody how good the market's doing here, and then we'll be right back. SP Futures up 60. We got some good news today. We might as well say it. NASDAQ Futures up 373. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello, welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell, Jimmy on the board. S&P Futures up 59. We were up 75, but still we're up a bunch. NASDAQ Futures up 351. They were up 475, so leaking a little bit still, but pretty darn strong. Dow's up 562. Let me see what's up. Goldman Sachs up 18. Home Depot up 4. IBM up 337. And the only clunker here is Chevron because oil's down a bunch. It's down $5. And Johnson & Johnson's down a whole dime. Other than that, the Dow is green. The transportation average is, transportation average is totally green except for, what do we got? KEX is down a penny, whoever the hell those guys are. Other than that, everybody's up, up, up and away. Actually, SpaceX is down 2.25 again, down to 112.78. That's not good because the Jimmy, was the opening price 135, and then it was 150 was the first printed price, and I think it traded 200 the first day. So John and I were talking about margin. God, if you bought it on margin at 210, you're getting a call. I hope nobody did that. Over in Asia, Nikkei up 320, it's 0.5%. Hang Seng up 243, that's a full percent. Shanghai up 44, that's 1.1%. So those guys are happy with the oil prices flying down because obviously they buy a lot of oil. Europe, DAX up 400, it's 1.6%. FTSE up 54.5, not as much, but still up. CAC around up 71.8. So by and large, a good day all around. Bonds, you know, the headline this morning was Treasury yields tumble as Middle East tensions ease. I got them down 3 basis points. It's not exactly a tumble. We're still 4.65, appreciably over the 4.5 alleged panic point, which turned out to not be much of a panic point. Oil, big news, down 5.28, but still 84.03. We're not 70 or anything anymore, but it's a big move because we're not shooting at anybody, which is a good day. Any day we're not shooting is a good day. RBOB down 9 cents, 3.30. It still puts, I would say, gas most places over 4, depending on your tax situation. Indiana, probably not, because they cut back on the state tax, which I think is like 40 cents, so they might still be under 4. Gold up $14, was up more, 4,085. Silver up 20 cents, 59.11, it was up more. So everything's kind of easing back just a hair. Foreign exchange, dollar retreats, but not much, because it's still, the euro's still under 114, the British pound's 133. Japanese yen, this is a bad one. If you're in Japan, still 163.65, well, it's got a little bit of relief today. And crypto up 176, 64,832. We have first traffic weather sports.
Still there, Tom?
I'm here.
Yeah, I'm here now. We blacked out for a minute, guys.
Jimmy, you're not going just before we proceed to real estate, Kevin texted.
Yes, we should be on.
You're on now.
Okay, a high of 87 with thunderstorms. In regards to Phoenix, we have whether it's going to be hot in Phoenix.
Kevin says I should stop repeating false teeth nonsense, but his president can say all the nonsense he wants.
Well, I've been to Luxembourg twice, Tom, and there's lots of smokestacks in Luxembourg City, let me tell you.
Speaking of Canada, I'm going to play a trailer from a movie called Canadian Bacon.
I have the results from the overnight tracking. Well, it's not fair. I mean, every other president had all of the Russians to blame for everything. What do I got?
For an unpopular president,
the voters felt that being alive or dead had no real bearing on their daily lives.
It's time to give war a chance.
Death.
What are we going to do for an enemy now?
A riot between Americans and Canadians broke out last night.
Now, with a little inspiration.
All I said was Canadian beer sucks.
Give me 1 week and I'll have Americans burning maple leaves.
They'll create a cause worth fighting for.
Is Canadian Prime Minister Clark MacDonald a member of a satanic cult?
That is stunning.
Canadians are always dreaming of a lot of ways to ruin our lives. The metric system, for the love of God.
Do not panic. I'm in complete...
Well, we have, Jimmy, we can barely hear that. Whatever you
did. Well, it was about Canadian bacon, and it's how the Canadians were undermining us. Because we ran out of people to fight. That this is from Michael Moore from Roger and Me.
Oh, God, yeah.
And so they came up with a thing that, you know, first off, millions of Canadians infiltrate our borders every day.
Okay, now we're going to talk about Luxembourg here as we try and defend our man. Kevin's right. We do get some iron, steel, and manufactured metal goods. Annually, the U.S. imports are roughly $900 million. However, trade primarily favors the U.S. with American exports, such as aerospace equipment and machinery, outpacing imports significantly. So there we go. All right. He's right. It's not just false teeth, although that was when they first were listed on the big chart, that was what was listed. I should have dug a little further, but I didn't. But it turns out we have a trade surplus with them. I guess they're still an enemy. So there you go. Hey, Nance, what's up with you? These rates can't be doing a lot of good, even though they're coming your way today.
What rates are coming? Are they going up? Did the 10-year go up again?
No, it's down today for the first time in a while, so it's got to be helping a tad today, but it hasn't really had a downtick in a while, has it?
No, it has not. I was just going to say, did it get worse? I mean,
we're still 4.65, but we're down. We almost made it to 4.7 on Friday. We're not doing that today, so maybe we'll come back a little bit, hopefully.
Yeah. No, rates have not been good. There's nothing. I mean, there's nothing good to say. People are just tired of. Some are just tired of waiting. So, you're seeing some people out looking. There's not enough inventory. It's the same thing, and I think it's just going to be this way for a while. Because people have to. They realize that there's not going to nothing, good's going to come from all this, right?
Yeah, well, I wonder, and I was on this thing last week where the guy kept asking me all these economic questions. It's different when you're not the moderator, people ask you questions, it's kind of different. But anyway, I said, no, none of this is tradable, but you sort of have to look at, where are deficits going, where interest rates are going, where inflation's going, what people are telling you versus actually happen, and you look at some of the risk things and you see what happened in Korea on the margin their margin loans, they allow people to borrow God knows how much for stock. And of course, the does that give you a it doesn't mean that's going to happen here, because those aren't our margin loans. We don't do that. We have a much more intelligent system, but still, it can be a problem. And over the last 3 months, my question is how susceptible. It seems like if you were to identify two things that we really are possible, absolute canaries in the coal mine, possibly, what could really screw us over? One would be, I'd say for some people, if crypto were to drop, I don't know what would cause it, what would not cause it, those kinds of things. I think if the stock were to drop, that's people's wealth bubble. If stocks were to drop 25%, oh God, I couldn't possibly do that. Well, they've been up that much in the last couple of years, so it could do that. Not saying it's going to. And what if housing prices all of a sudden drop 20-25%? Could it happen? It has before. Hope it doesn't. What is the susceptibility of that? I mean, it's a possibility. I hope it's a remote possibility, but it's not something I don't think you can necessarily ignore, can you?
I mean, I think everyone's doing a great job of ignoring it. I mean, people always want more. They want better, right? And people have been waiting a long time for things to get better, and it's just not better right now. I mean, they want to see the prosperity we had in the 90s, in the 2000s. I mean, well, up until the crash. So they've been waiting, and they I'm sure they feel they've been waiting a long time. So what can we say to all this? I mean, we're going to continue, I guess, waiting, because one individual or group or whatever, we have no control. But I mean, I've talked to people who feel that, if you make everybody makes $50 an hour, all these problems would go away. I personally do not believe that, but okay. And then you have more and more people wanting a work-life balance. So you're not going to see anybody working to save up to be able to buy more and put more money down. Do you follow what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, I hear all these people saying what they want. I mean, I had someone on, I think it was Thursday, tell me, I don't file tax returns. I don't have any 1099s. I don't have to look up any of that stuff. And I just want the loan.
Good luck.
Yeah, well, you can't, I mean, you can't be rude and say that, but, it's just so difficult to get people to face the reality.
I should bust my ass for a continual tax dodger.
No, I mean, she says she doesn't have to file, so I said, that's fine. Some people don't, but yeah. I said, you at least have to produce the 1099s because they're giving you income. And I'm not going to do that. And well, okay, that's fine, but nothing good is going to happen out of this. You're never going to hit the successful goal of owning a home.
I don't think that, Jan, what's the number? Not having to file, like $1,500 or something? It's way low.
Oh, not yeah. Yet.
I don't know.
It's, boy,
I don't
boy.
Know. But I was just like, okay, but you see where, I mean, it's so difficult to get, I mean, you don't even have to talk about the property you're looking for. If you don't have a cooperating person, it's never going to work. And I'm seeing a lot more attitudes like that. And I'm just learning to say, I'm sorry. I don't think that, it's going to work or it's going to go anywhere, because those are the things I need. So go find, I mean, and they're claiming that they're getting pre-approval letters from the banks, but you got to remember, when you're at a bank, you could just be getting a, I don't want to use the word clerk because it makes it sound horrible, but you're just getting someone who's really not versed in what they need. They're just there to get the information. So if you want to say, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that, that's fine. Well, and they can write you a pre-approval letter or a pre-qualification letter, but it doesn't mean anything. Well, and people are wise to this. So I just don't know. you know, I mean, you're talking about what's going to happen with people. I mean, we need an attitude adjustment.
Well, I think that it, you know, you'll get all kinds of debate on this.
I'm sure.
That the people who you elect, you know, I don't think anybody's 100% perfect. What did they used to say? Even a just person sins 10 times a day, at least in thought or something. You can't have a period of time where we're pushing between the two people we've had in office, this guy and Biden and his son and so forth. We've had a situation for 12, the people who are the number one people in the country are essentially kleptocrats. Stole everything they possibly could, one way or the other. Biden did it, this guy did it, or first term maybe not as much, but this term it's all over the place. What would possess anybody in this country, other than somebody who may have been brought up that way and just thinks it's the way you ought to be, what would possess me to really bust my ass and pay every single dime into income tax when I know these people are just stealing it? I mean, at some point it filters down, and people will argue with me on that. You're hiring somebody to be president who knows the economy and is tough on people around the world, whether they should be or not. You don't really care about his moral fiber. I think that's bullshit. I think you have to care about their moral fiber because they are our main person. And I think right now anybody who thinks that, you know, it's a mortal sin for stealing a dime on your income tax, boy, you're not watching the news, or you're gonna have a lot of company in hell. What do you think, John? I mean, why would anybody feel they've got to be moral in this country compared to these people? I never thought I'd say that.
Well, we got, you know, some bad models that are a lot closer to home than, you know, Washington. I mean, look at the amount of COVID money that was defrauded.
Yeah, well, I'm saying
by teachers, by policemen, by, you know, city workers, people who, you know, you need, and you think they have the kind of attitude that translates to, you know, good
values. I wouldn't be doing
that. Classroom or, yeah, or when you're out on the line as a policeman that you're protecting the public. But if they're really, you know, and I don't know if they're taking their cues from higher ups, because we've done everything possible to make it easy for people to cheat, and we don't really imprison enough people to discourage anybody else from doing it. So, you know, we're to blame too ourselves.
Well, with this constant, you know, I'm to blame. Just because you had two people in the the city clerk's office trying to get COVID money, one of my attorney buddies, I don't know if I ever told you this, Nance. They were going after people who they filed false applications.
Okay.
But then they never got the money.
Okay.
Yet, and I'm not saying anybody should do that. You know, I mean, I'm certainly not going to absolve that. But they obviously thought better of it at some point and never got the money. Yet we're expending time and effort, because those are the people we can go after that are essentially defenseless. Spend time and effort to go over those people. Or maybe people who got 10 grand or something. I'm not justifying it. But we seem like the top's stealing, and we're spending all our law enforcement money on the bottom trying to find the crumbs. And which is not justify the people on the bottom doing some cheating, but I mean, when you look at the actual money that was taken, and there's a website that it'll let you know every dime everybody got in the whole state.
Oh, you're kidding.
Oh, no, God bless, your memory's better than mine. What, there's like 265,000 companies that got money, or 235 or something? I'll look that up, but it's a massive amount. And some people, by the letter of the law, weren't crooks. Yet there are, I'll just, the biggest example, the people who worked all the way through COVID, guess what? The garbage men worked, right? Duh. In a town, let's say like Orland, you probably...
I worked.
But I'm saying you probably have a scavenger contract with somebody. Who knows if it's Flood Brothers or somebody. Those people got all the wages as if they weren't in business. They probably got $4 or $5 million, yet they never missed a paycheck. City always paid. They never missed a day. And a couple of the places that you and Audrey and I go, because people talk to me, I don't know why they do, but they do, a couple of restaurants that we go had their two best years and still got $300,000 to $700,000 from the government, as if they were closed. But guess what? They were open and had their best year. Meanwhile, it's technically legal, okay? But meanwhile, there's a few people that filed the applications that never got the money. So just to review how this worked, there was two layers. There was the first one, then there was the Employee Retention Act or something? Was the second one, Jen?
Yeah.
And that particular one, you essentially applied for a loan, okay? You applied for a loan and you got the loan. But it was a loan with interest and a payback to it. So that application, you know, maybe you lied on it, maybe you didn't. I'm not saying you should ever lie on anything. But some people maybe lied on the application. But you got the money. But you had to pay that back. There was a second document that you sent in that said, by the way, I used the money for salaries, for this and that. And it originally started, it had to be like 90% salary. This is a long time ago. And that was about it. But then after a while, the government realized that everybody, an awful lot of people had cheated on this. So as time went by, they started adding, okay, you could take in 10% rent, you could take in 10%, because they figured just about everybody wasn't exactly accurate in their estimation. So the firms that were totally legit, like us, for instance, we could have applied for a hell of a lot more, but we didn't. We were absolutely letter of the law. And it turns out we could have included a bunch of other stuff. But the second document one says, okay, Nancy's Mortgage Place went out and you guys got a loan for $40,000, say. You got to pay that back, Nance, with interest. But then a second document came in and said, I used the $40,000 to pay salaries for Joe and Jane, and here's the proof. You sent that back in, and the loan got forgiven. Okay. Okay. And so the idea, only the first document, even if the first document was wrong, you owed the money. The second document was the one, if you lied on, you actually got to keep the dough. So why they're prosecuting anybody for the first document, I have no idea, especially if you never got the money. John, am I right on it? I mean, talk about a waste of time.
It's elective prosecution, too. If you pick some bigger target, you know, that crook could hire a white shoe law firm that's also crooked and find a judge who's also crooked, and at most maybe get a fine out of it. Nobody can go to jail. So it's just a game the people play. The people at the lower end, may actually get completely cleaned out by the system, and that's all they need to do. Just do one or two, low hanging fruit, and they've got the right kind of control.
You made your day.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, let's get back.
Just to think about real estate for a minute. What's happening with the downtown buildings and their collapse in values and the short-term, commercial loans these, owners get that, they don't drag out for 20 years. They don't drag out for 10 years. They're much shorter term than that. And a lot of these banks, I think, are facing horrible balance sheets when, they try to unload these buildings that are worth one.
Jim, back up a second. The real big ones that you send me the text on and stuff, the real big buildings that are, went for 160 and now they're going for, 60 or something. I don't really see any, it's not like the First National Bank or the Continental Bank were on, though. Who's doing the financing? It's these big groups of people, right? Do you even know who it is?
Well, there's, groups of banks. It's
conglomerates. Are they banks or not?
They're pension funds. There's, all sorts of, and they combine. Some of these buildings required a lot of money to finance, and what was more than, Chase or some institutional lender might be interested in sinking into a place. But they have the same, risk whether they're, part of the borrowing conglomerate, the lending conglomerate, or the single one, and it's only their money involved. All of these places are taking a bath. And some of them are banks. They're banks that got a piece of the debt and expected to make a certain amount of money out of it quick, short term gain, and that they'll never see it. And I'm just worried at some point this is going to be a banking problem, if it's not already a banking problem, that's going to really take a toll on residential lending too.
Well, if I can paraphrase what you just said, the inability to figure out who exactly the people are might become a problem. Right?
It'll cause enough uncertainty and delay, to prevent people from knowing who's really in peril here, and how quickly entity A is on the precipice of bankruptcy before it's too late. So nobody has a chance to kind of read the signals ahead of time.
You've been on the show for 10 years. How long have we been trying to figure out who owes the China people money? We can't figure that out either, huh?
No.
Well, Nance, but the people with the houses now, are they have any idea? Oh, I know what I want to mention to you. The last week, the report came out that first-time buyers are only buying 21% of the houses now. It's a total new low. Is that what you're seeing?
Tom, I don't know. I don't know anything about that kind of a number.
You've been saying for a while there's not a whole lot of first-time buyers out there.
Correct, but I don't know what the reasoning is behind it. I mean, like this person I was describing earlier was a first-time homebuyer. I mean, if that's what your expectations are as a first-time homebuyer, and then she wanted the down payment money for free. She wants assistance and.
If you pull this off, John and I are coming over to you. We're going to buy like five houses with nothing down.
No. I mean, there's nothing. All I can say is that I'm not sure, who they're considering a. Well, then the story got worse because she said that someone has to co-sign, but the co-signer shouldn't be on the mortgage, and. It doesn't matter if he's a first-time homebuyer or not. Well, you see what I'm saying? I just don't understand people's expectations anymore. It just doesn't work.
I think it's kind of hard to.
Yeah, I'm discouraged at what I'm seeing, but then again, things do change. Things can change around in 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Right now, it's just extremely. Off, but then again, it's the end of July going into August, and people have to get their kids back to school and stuff like that. But the first-time homebuyers, the availability for them, they don't want, they want turnkey and walk in and everything be perfect. It doesn't happen that way. It just doesn't.
Well, they want it because they're every nickel's in the mortgage, right?
Well, yes. So, but, I mean... Like on my first home, I was a first time home buyer. I mean, I happened to buy a brand new condo being built. I was very fortunate, but really in the era I came up with, people bought rundown things and they fixed them up over time, and they made the best of it until they had the money to do that.
Well, that's right.
Are your clients typically? Coming to you for pre-approval before they really start house hunting, or are they coming to you after they've had an offer accepted on a house?
Most of the time, honest to God, I mean, I have a lot of word of mouth referrals, so most of the time the people come to me ahead of time because I will tell them what they can afford to buy. I mean, seriously, what's going to fly, not just what somebody's going to tell you. So they usually come before, for the most part. And if I do get them when they need the pre-approval, that's a very rushed situation. And you have to, if that happens, usually the realtor should have known that, they're not pre-approved. I mean, what are we doing here?
Well, if you were good, Audrey, and you got the client, and they'll say, well, we think we can do this here, and Aud will always recommend that they come to you.
Correct.
And say, okay,
well,
this is...
Yeah, because we've been, I mean, she's been burned with people coming, and then they don't, at the end of the day, they don't really qualify.
Well, plus it's illuminating for them, too. It's not something they shouldn't know. I mean, it's a positive for both sides, for everybody, I think.
Do you see any clients that are pre-approved and then they have to come back to you at some point, not having found a property? and they just give up the home search completely, even though they had pre-approval?
You know, I have had that happen, John, but it's usually because one of the two people are, you know, have an expectation that is just unrealistic. And usually when they come back, they're calling to say, you know, I'm sorry, like, I'm sorry I wasted your time, you worked hard on this, blah, blah, blah. And then that's when I say, well, then they'll say, well, could we have done something different? And I'll say, well, I think if you'd have looked at it in this light, you would have been, you know, better off. And then if you still want to continue looking, call the agent back, or I'll call the agent and explain the situation, and then they usually have found their dream home. It just isn't what they were looking for to begin with. I mean, there's always something out there you can get that will make you happy, and have, maybe if you have 10 things you want, maybe you get 8 out of the 10, with the 9th and 10th being available maybe later, a couple years down the road. But sometimes people just don't realize they're their own worst enemies. I mean, there are ways around things.
Yeah, it's one of our, well, John and I know him real well, but an attorney friend of ours, you know, he does a lot of tax work, but he can do closings too for friends, and of course he never charges anybody. And so one of his daughter's friends buys a condo downtown, and he calls me the next day and he goes, you know, every nickel's in the place. He goes, literally, we went out to dinner after. Of course, he always picks up the tab. He goes, I had to pick up the tab. every penny was in the place. You know, is that still going on, or is that are people getting a little wise to that?